From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in rural Edgefield County, South Carolina, in the 1970s. It's a quiet place and quietly magical. The loblolly pines, the clear stars at night, and the birds. So many kinds of birds. And in that sleepy county, a young boy saw the birds and wanted to fly. He'd see birds fly, he decided he should do it too. Maybe put on cardboard wings or jump off the roof with an umbrella. Bruises, scrapes, failures. Our bones are denser. It doesn't really work out this way. Humans are not made for the air, which came as a great disappointment to this young man. And did the birds in the sky even appreciate the chance they had? Did they take it for granted? Well, the boy and then the young man became obsessed with nature. But he was also learning that conservation, zoology, ecology, these are fields of study with very few people who look like him. Drew Lanham is black, and he knew early on that he wanted to spend his career in nature. He's discovered that his mission goes beyond studying the birds he loved as a child. It's about helping other children of color see the opportunity that he saw. He's now an alumni distinguished professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University. He's written a book just out called The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. And today he's in Rochester, meeting with students and also going to be giving a free public presentation tonight. We're going to learn about that in just a second. Let me welcome him, Drew Lanham, author of The Home Place. Great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And also here is Pamela Reed Sanchez from the Seneca Park Zoo Society, the executive director who helped make all of this possible. How did you get in touch with Drew? I want to know that story.
That's actually a really funny story. I was with a colleague down at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and I picked up a book from their bookshop called Birding for Everyone by John Robinson. And I started reading about the disconnect between nature studies and people of color in general, and became a little fascinated about this. You know, we've got a lot of problems in Rochester related to race, related to poverty, and we've had trouble with our waterways and keeping them clean. And I think there's a connection there between the anti-poverty initiatives and the environment. And I shared this with this colleague, and he somehow found this YouTube video, Rules of a Black Birder with Drew Lanham. And I put it on my Facebook page and connected a couple people in town, Laura Kammermeyer, who's the president of the Rochester Birding Association, and Sean Dunwoody, community activist, and said, this looks like a project for us. And Laura said, that's my friend Drew. I'm sure he'll come in and speak to kids. And so that's how Drew and I connected. And I'm so grateful that that's happened.
That video is awesome. And we've got a clip of it. You know, it's about 2 minutes long. I posted it on Twitter this morning and I said, trust me when I tell you, you should watch this. You should read the book. You should listen to this guy. But I've got a short clip of it. So let's listen to it. And we'll ask Drew about making this video, Rules of a Black Birder.
You know, they're essential tools for birding. They're your binoculars, your spotting scope, your field guide. And if you're black, you're gonna need probably two or three forms of ID. Never wear a hoodie, ever. The word for an African American in camouflage is incognito. Blackbirds are your birds. Red-winged blackbirds, grackles, rusty blackbirds, brewer's blackbirds, black scoters, you claim black brant, crows, ravens, and blackbirds are largely maligned. Any bird that's black is my bird. But if you're a black birder and you're gonna bird at night, you better be careful because you might be perceived as being up to no good. Be prepared to be confused with the other black birder. When I meet another black birder, it's like encountering an ivory-billed woodpecker, an endangered species. Extinction looms. These are the rules for the black birder.
That is from that video. And look, Drew, I got to tell you, I didn't want to laugh. I felt mixed emotions there. The first time I watched it and I heard, don't wear a hoodie, I laughed because you're being a little cheeky, right? And then I thought of Trayvon.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of those things. And I go, why am I laughing? What did you want me to feel with that?
Yeah, Evan, you know, that... Well, I wanted you to think about, I wanted you to laugh, then I wanted you to think about why you laughed.
And it worked.
And then I wanted you to think about why you had to think about why you laughed. And so it was, you know, I've lived a lot of that. It's satire, obviously, and there's some hyperbole built in. But really, for most of my life, I've been a birder, and I've been the only black birder that I've known. So I would encounter myself in the mirror. But not many others. I don't think I encountered my first black birder other than myself until I was maybe 40. So, you know, that's been sort of this long trail, but writing those nine rules, the editor from Orion Magazine, where that was first published, asked me if I was interested in doing a piece for Enumeration in their fine magazine. And I said, sure. And she said, well, you know, she emailed me, you know, get back to me in a couple of days. And I was back to her in 45 minutes because it's just the life that I've lived. And yeah, I've always sort of seen myself as a bird, but being able to self-describe who I am as a birder was an opportunity for both introspection and to sort of hopefully inform the larger public.
I had flagged one of your passages in your book. Can I just read from this then?
Sure.
From page 141, from the chapter on the Bluebird of Enlightenment. But here's what you wrote about how you viewed yourself. You wrote, black and white, good and evil, ideas harped on by religious folks, preached from some pulpit or broadcast on television, were an ice on the pool of my consciousness. There are preconceived notions of where I should go, of what I should do, and even of who I should do it with, of who I am supposed to be as a black man. But my choice of career and my passion for wildness means that I will forever be the odd bird, the raven in a horde of white doves, the blackbird in a flock of snow buntings, end quote. So you've found that some parallel to the birds that you loved in that, huh?
Yeah, man. It's that's a constant. You know, it's again, it's the life because I wanted to be a bird. It's easiest for me to find my life in birds and to describe how it is that I am and how I feel by the birds that I obsess over. And, you know, I find myself falling into this position again of being who it is that I love. And I suppose there's some sort of psychological exercise in it, really. But in writing that and in being for most of my life sort of the only one or one of few doing what it is that I do, there's this sort of subconscious loneliness about it. And I have great friends who may not share my skin tone, but who share what it is that I do. And they're wonderful. They're absolutely amazing. I love them. But then at the end of the day, you know, you wonder, where are the other people? Because I know that there are other people of color who admire nature, who revel in it, who find solace in it, who enjoy all sorts of things, birds, butterflies, boulders, whatever it might be. But where are they? And why aren't they there? And so that led to sort of this litany of questions.
So in this hour, I'd like to talk about the book that is, it's a remarkable book. It's called The Home Place. Ignorantly, I didn't even know how new it is. You haven't even had the book release party, is that right? Or what's going on?
No, so from Rochester, I'll go to Minneapolis, Minnesota, the home place of Milkweed Editions. And we'll have the launch party there later this week.
And listeners, you know, we had a bunch of books lately. It's just been sort of one of these streaks. And so it's a lot of reading. And you hear me praise some authors. You may think that I give false praise. I will not sell you a bill of goods as a listener. And Megan Mack, producer, knows that we vet pretty strongly on what comes in the door here. I think the book is beautiful. It is, it's so interesting to hear about the place you grew up in. And how you perceived, you know, family life, the home structures that, you know, that you had. Mm-hmm. So I want to kind of work through some of that with you. But let me make sure we'll step back and give you a little bit more details on what's going on tonight. So Pamela Reed Sanchez, what's going on? What do you want the public to know about Drew's visit today?
I want them to come out and meet Drew tonight at 7 o'clock at RIT in the College of Liberal Arts Auditorium. The lecture is free and open to the public. It'll be about an hour, and then you'll have an opportunity to purchase his book there and have it signed. So very grateful to the RIT Office of Diversity and Inclusion for helping to make this happen. They've underwritten the travel expenses for Drew to be here, and it's been a great partnership. Drew was out at RIT speaking to some of their students yesterday, met a broad range of students from a wide range of places, actually, from Rochester to Guyana. So,
okay, and so tonight, 7 o'clock?
Tonight at 7 o'clock.
And where? One more time.
College of Liberal Arts Auditorium.
Okay. And has the Zoo Society posted information if people want to grab it online?
Yes, they can go online and get it. Yep.
All right. Seneca Park Zoo Society, if you want to check that out with Drew Lanham, who's here. Because Drew, you know, this is a visit not just to talk about your book, but to talk about this issue. So here in Rochester, we have the highest concentration of child poverty of any city of its size in the country. And we know that kids who grew up in urban centers in poverty, they don't see a lot of green space. And you write in the book, and I'm glad to hear you say this, that it doesn't have to be Edgefield County, it doesn't have to be the kind of setting you grew up in to gain a love of nature. That sometimes it's grass sticking through a sidewalk. Sometimes it's a small park space in an urban setting. But I got sort of a number of questions on this scale. So number one, do we need more green space in our cities?
Absolutely. You know, more green space everywhere. I mean, it's sort of epidemic, Evan, I think. You know, of course, Richard Louv wrote about nature deficit disorder, but then many people have said that when the majority in the United States gets a cold, then the minority gets the flu. And so we're suffering from some sort of really virulent disconnect from nature in many communities of color. So yeah, any green space, but you know, that the first step, I think, beyond kind of the green space is getting people to simply notice the environment around them. And, you know, in some places that's become pretty obvious. When Flint, Michigan, for example, the water comes out of the spigot and it's brown. And then you're set on this course of noticing and reacting at a very different level. So there's, you know, there are conversations about privilege in our country that we have that are terribly complex, but there's also some privilege, I think, that's associated with what it is that we do and that we need to talk about in a conversation about green space and privilege and nature study and what that means, and that peeling back from that conversation ultimately to make nature relevant in ways that's meaningful to survival. And then once people have clean water, they have clean air, they have safe spaces in which to live and sustain themselves beyond some poverty line, then we can join a conversation about nature study and noticing nature in a way that I think is empathetic.
So when you talk to kids, you know, whether it's elementary school, middle school, especially those kind of ages, you know, I mean, I think most kids, no matter your background, poverty or not, privilege or not, kind of love animals. Mm-hmm. They kids, for the most part, like to get outside and play, and eventually we start to kind of wean that out of them. But when you talk to kids, especially kids of color, and they hear your story, and you tell them, you know, you didn't even meet a black birder until you were 40. You're sort of alone in this field. Are they even thinking about this as an interest, let alone a career? Do they have questions for you about that? I mean, is this even on their radar?
Yeah, you know, you get, and Pamela has given me the opportunity to speak to several groups of children this week. And so, yeah, they come up with some really interesting questions. But I think the first thing is them sort of assessing who it is that I am. You know, I mean, I'm this guy that's old enough to be father or grandfather to some of them. And so there's this initial assessment in trying to figure out who it is that I am. And then maybe an owl call comes out of my mouth or a peacock call this morning. And they're intrigued. And then
peacocks make noise.
They do. So, you know, that sort of breaks the ice. And but they have questions. You know, we were at Humboldt Center, I believe it was,
yesterday,
Pamela, and I'm showing slides, and these kids are sort of amped up. You know, it's right after school, and we're talking about animals, and this kid just sort of says, "Have you ever seen a hermit thrush?" And I did a double take, because here's this group of kids sort of wound up in themselves and interacting. And he's not asking me about ostriches or peacocks or any sort of exotic bird, but a hermit thrush that's a beautiful bird that breeds and migrates through Rochester that we only get in the wintertime in South Carolina. But this muted, cinnamon-tailed, brown-backed, spot-breasted thrush that lives in the shadows. And I'm wondering how this child that I didn't have expectations of knowing anything about birds, much less the hermit thrush, has surprised me. And so at that level of surprise, that level of him exceeding any expectation that I had, that shows me that there's hope for moving people forward in that way. Now, he never let me know how he knew what a hermit thrush was, but somewhere that bird entered his psyche. And that's all it takes, is just some spot for a wildflower or for some bug or for a cloud, you know, to enter somebody's psyche, that they look up or that they look down and they notice. And that if there is some minuscule spot of green space there, maybe they want more. And I, you know, for most nature lovers, there's this greed, this crave to want more of it. And so I think once we begin to feed people and get people to points where they can want more, that's sort of the momentum that you want to build.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think of the spaces in the city that we love seeing. We were at Turning Point Park recently, Pamela, and just my son riding a bike on there. Just incredible. It's just this, it to me kind of looks like coastal Carolina, though.
Hmm. It does. It does.
Okay, because I thought Drew would probably say, yeah, you don't know what coastal Carolina, but no, it has that feel, right? It doesn't feel like Rochester. And it's not a huge space. I mean, it's pretty big, but I imagine kids just walking there and looking around and feeling the sense of wonder. But I also worry about something else kind of related to this, Drew. I think about kids in poverty, kids of all backgrounds in poverty, feeling like options are limited to them, mm-hmm. teaching, ecology, whatever it is. And how do we create a world where kids growing up in poverty, and especially kids of color, are even aware that they've got options? You know, that sometimes it takes meeting someone like you to say, you know, wow, you know, ecology, these kind of things could be a hobby, could be a passion, could be a career. But I fear that we have a world where a lot of kids are growing up and it's not even an option in their mind, you know?
Yeah.
And how do you get that to change?
Well, you first have to listen. You ask the question of what do you want to be? And more than that, I increasingly ask people what they want to do. What do you want to do? And what you want to do can become what you want to be. And so for those kids, understanding what their dreams are, and once you have some understanding that they do have aspirations beyond now, then again, that's an entry for helping them understand what the possibilities are. And that was the greatest gift that so many people along the way gave to me, is that they did not limit in any way. Most people didn't limit my possibilities. You know, there were people who wanted to tell me what the probabilities were. They wanted to tell me that, well, you're good at math and science, you're black, so you should be an engineer because you can make money there. We know that money is important to you, but nobody ever really asked what was important to me. They didn't ask. They assumed that money was the first thing on my mind, that I wanted a job that paid me a lot of money. And they said, engineers make a lot of money. You can bird in your spare time.
What if you wanted to teach? Not enough money?
Yeah. Well, and that's, again, you know, that's one of those fields where, you know, people aren't, especially black males. My God. I mean, and that's, you know, talk about an epidemic shortage. You know, there's a shortage period of people of color in the classroom, black men in the classroom. My father was a black man in the classroom. My grandfather did that. So there's a legacy of it for me. So I had some understanding of the importance and privilege of being able to teach. It's an honorable profession, but it's been distilled into what it is now, and it's a profession that's not worthy somehow, that it doesn't pay enough. It's not glamorous. It's hard work. And so I don't think we've done a good job of connecting to that legacy that used to be prevalent in the black community, of teachers who were community leaders, who were sages. And so that step from really a guidance counselor level, from those people who are career counselors, in laying out all of the possibilities, all of the probabilities that are out there for kids and helping them understand, you know, if you're here, this is how you get there. And let me show you someone who can help you. Now, the important thing here, it's important, I think, yeah, always to see someone that looks like you doing what it is that you may want to do. But that is not, that's not essential. It's important, but not essential. Many of the people who helped me along the way weren't Black. And so the mindset that I had to have, which in part was born of my parents, was that you have to be able to assess people on an individual basis, those people who will help you, to give them an entryway into helping you. So teaching, ecology, those fields, the fields sort of outside of the norm. It's easy to sort of pigeonhole and say, you know what, you're good at math and science, do this. And that's kind of formulaic. You know, I would rather than sort of this paint by number that we have for careers and what you do, instead of paint by numbers that we maybe let things bleed outside the lines in some sort of watercolor and people can take advantage of their passions.
I talked to a retired superintendent who had this exact concern that when students of color are excelling, there's this view that we have to take advantage with the highest paying career possible. And again, no, listen, I'm not at all denigrating high-income careers. That's good.
No, not at all.
But to the exclusion even of some other options that are out there. And that's how students kind of get pushed in certain directions. And all of a sudden, the turnover rate gets pretty high. I mean, for you, your story of kind of walking away or sort of having that moment, I thought was fascinating.
Well, I know I can go to within probably 3 to 5 feet of where I made that literal turn on.
Can you tell us, tell listeners, you know, again, we're not spoiling too much here in the book here, but tell the listeners sort of set the scene here for what was going on in your life.
Well, my father had died, and I wanted to support myself going to school. I didn't want extra burden, financial burden on my mother. And so I had been in several summer programs, sort of these STEM types of programs. And I had been targeted and identified and won one of 4 national DuPont scholarships to send me to school in engineering anywhere in the United States that also guaranteed summer employment as an intern and guaranteed employment in any of the DuPont facilities worldwide. And so I went into engineering because they were giving me money to go to school, even though I had partial scholarships to go elsewhere in marine biology and do other things. This was money that I could not turn down. And so I went to Clemson in engineering and was doing pretty well, got through roughly 3.5 years. And still had my head above water, was still above a 3.0, and was on my way to a class one morning. And I used to stop by this building, long haul, and it was where all of the zoologists were. It's where people were doing the stuff, and it smelled like, you know, it smelled like life. But I was going to these engineering classes and, you know, figuring out stresses and strains and forces and all that sort of stuff. And I'm on the way to class one spring morning. It's the spring semester. And I got to a point and I just stopped. I stopped in my tracks. And I turned around. And I went back to my apartment, and I think I ate a bowl of Fruit Loops. and I watched cartoons, and kind of in the dark. And I called my scholarship sponsor, and I said, you know, I can't do this anymore. And I'd been begging, can I change? And she said, no. She said, if you do this, you're going to lose your scholarship. And I said, well, then I guess I'll lose my scholarship. So at that point, you know, I'm free. Don't know exactly how I'm going to pay for my education beyond that, but I'm free. And so I go to Long Hall and I meet my eventual undergraduate advisor, Dr. Jim Schindler, who's just an amazing man, a limnologist. He studied lakes, originally from Minnesota, I believe. And so he took me under his wing, trusted me, saw that passion was important to me. And I lost that scholarship. I took out a student loan for a couple of semesters, and then these amazing scholarships just sort of fell my way. And so that was the turning point in my life. And it was, I think it was a point of survival for me, Evan, because if I had continued on that track, I would have been miserable. And miserable for me meant maybe not living the fullest life that I could lead, and I wasn't happy. And I didn't know where that was going to lead, but I knew that I had to get out. And so in that spot, in that place, in that decision to turn around and not go to that class that day over a bowl of Fruit Loops and watching Transformers, I was transformed. I was made into who it is that I am now.
I just have to say, I mean, this comes at a time where I'm doing a lot of deep dive into some of the numbers, and I found this so interesting and instructive because right now in this country, something like 16% of public school students, K-12 in this country, are black, and 16% of college students are black. We don't have a huge enrollment issue. We have a completion issue. We have college completion. So something is happening to black students at the college level that is preventing them from graduating at the same rates, from getting degrees at the same rates. And sometimes it's, you know, whether it's a high-achieving student being pushed in a direction that they're not comfortable with, and then there's a turnover rate. Sometimes it is money and access, and students who don't get scholarships and don't feel the access. But I did feel like Drew's story was really instructive for me. Here's this driven person with a passion, but felt he was pushed in the wrong direction. And at that moment, when you went back to have Fruit Loops instead of going on with your day, a lot of things could have changed. A lot of different directions could have happened. And it went very, very well for you. And I just think, you know, there's just so much to learn. So let me get our only break of the hour. I'll come back to your phone calls. I see the phone ringing. I have a couple comments that I'll just read real quick here. Somebody admonishing me, and maybe you'll appreciate this. Rob just wants me to know, Evan, just wanted you to know that University in South Carolina that your guest is from is pronounced Clemson, not Clemson. So Rob was very attuned to how I pronounced that. And is he right?
He's all good, yeah.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that, Rob. I always appreciate that. Thank you, Rob, for that. And Mark just said, I'm sitting in my driveway and I'm not getting out until the conversation's over. So we've got an official driveway moment right now with a different listener named Mark. So Mark, thank you for that.
Thank you.
But if you have to get out of your driveway and you got to go on with your day, Mark, that's fine, because Pamela Reed Sanchez is about to tell you where you can meet Drew Lanham tonight. Where can you meet him?
You can meet him tonight at RIT, at the College of Liberal Arts Auditorium, at 7 o'clock with a book signing after his lecture.
The book is The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. And the last point I'll make before our short break is this. We're focusing on sort of his directional changes, his story of growing up, especially as a man of color in a field where there's very little diversity. But so much of this book to me was just great descriptions of nature, wildlife. And I'm not an expert. I love it. I mentioned I've got a 4.5-year-old son. One night last winter, it's December, we heard this noise in the neighborhood. No idea what it was. We go outside. He's shining a flashlight up in the trees. I'm pretty sure it turned out to be a screech owl.
Mm-hmm.
You know that? I don't know what that sounds like.
Yeah.
It's like a... Oh my gosh, exactly right. Reese, if you're listening to this podcast, that's it. Screech owl. But you know, he couldn't wait to find out what it was. That is me this entire book, reading about the wildlife and the places and the scenery. So if you love nature, but even if you're not a super enthusiast, but you love that stuff, the imagery is just great. So it's not just a book about a black man in a white field. It's got all kinds of stuff. So that's the book. Let's get a short break. Come back with Drew Lanham and your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections. Nate Silver, mathematician extraordinaire, says the polls show a dead heat, a coin flip between Trump and Clinton. If you're starting to get worried, no matter what side you're on, a question. Are you going to sit on the couch, or are you willing to volunteer? Go to a swing state, do some work. We'll talk about how to get involved in the election process, especially if you've never done it before. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Drew Lanham, author of The Home Place, is my guest, along with Pamela Reed Sanchez, the executive director of the Seneca Park Zoo Society. And we'll grab a phone call. Bonnie in Rochester first up. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. The conversation with your guest makes me think of the River School, which was proposed for Rochester. It comes out of this education humanity movement.
Humane education, yep.
Yeah, and unfortunately, well, let me say something about what it is first. It's a wonderful idea. It's an interdisciplinary approach, and the particular River school name is because they want to focus on nature and a lot of the water-related dynamics in the area, plus leading to options, as your guest was so clearly explaining, that, you know, often what happens is that people are placed in areas that they're not necessarily want to go in, and also I think people of color often even more so. So this would offer a really wider, and it's quite interesting. And they wanted to be a public school. The people who run this really wanted to be a public school system. Unfortunately, when they went to the school board, economic reasons or whatever, they were not able to accommodate them. So I think now what they're doing is trying to get funding, raise money for charter school. But these kinds of opportunities are good for really everyone, because they open people's eyes to really what's going on, especially in the time of climate change. We really have to, you know, understand what's going on so we can make decisions before it's kind of too late. So I would hope that these kinds of things would be fed in schools around the city, visits to the schools, so that people would know more about them, and to advocate for this river school, which I think is a really great plan. I've read it, and I really think it's wonderful.
Bonnie, thank you. Go ahead, Pamela.
The river school is based on the success of the Harbor School in New York, where they're teaching all kinds of vocational opportunities, from underwater welding to, you know, ecology. And it is a tremendous success down there. And they're doing real science, really meaningful hands-on science, bringing back oysters to the area, filtering the water, and doing all kinds of water quality assessments. I would love to see an effort there, and the Zoo Society would definitely be helpful in that effort. We've done a lot of work, as you know, Evan, in the Genesee, in assessing the biodiversity there. So couldn't agree with more with her. It's a great opportunity, and we'd love to see that happen.
Drew, are schools still trapped too much in an old model of classrooms around this country?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, there's this sort of course, this pressure to teach to the test.
Yep.
And, And with that pressure comes less time to sort of be amorphous. And that's one of the things. And play is an opportunity for a child to be amorphous and to sort of flow into these different places and find the things and observe. And we just don't give kids that sort of time anymore, not in the traditional public school setting. So, if I were king of education, there'd have to be an hour of play every day, and there would have to be time to savor food and not wolf it down, and there would be less teaching to these tests. And, you know, we talk about STEM and STEAM as part of curricula, but environmental education frequently gets the short shrift. And so part of what's happened with me and working on this book and meeting new and fresh faces in environmental education, you know, I've sort of come to understand that it's part of what I've been doing all along. But it's more than pulling a water sample and sort of looking kind of narrowly at nature. I think it's an opportunity for us, with huge issues like climate change, to make issues like that relevant to children, so that they are engaged now. There's really not an opportunity to deny the science that's there. So, yeah, but that means that we would have to peel back and be less structured.
Okay.
Certainly.
And two listener questions piggyback off that. You essentially just answered one. Wendy in Rochester called in to ask, what does Drew think of the new testing regime in terms of how it helps kids find their passion? It sounds to me more like you're a little concerned it could keep them from finding other passions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, from what I understand and what I know, those aren't tests that help students understand what it is that they want to be. It doesn't necessarily open all of the possibilities to them, that the world is sort of this limitless place. Instead, they're limited by some score that tracks them, and quickly.
All right. Well, and the other question on a subject you just mentioned, Alan wrote to the program and wanted to know if climate change has meant you're seeing different birds or species where you are.
Yeah, well, you know, part of what we see in sort of this exercise of range mapping is things hanging around longer because resources are there. you know, and the drivers for birds, for migration, one of the drivers is food, obviously. So, you know, with warmer temperatures and later frost kills, you've got bugs hanging around that that historically probably weren't. But you also see range expansions of a bird like a Carolina wren. That's the state bird of South Carolina. And those birds have expanded their range northward into places like New York, where they weren't traditionally. They're occasionally pushed back by harsh winters. But so, yeah, climate changes. I travel across the country and I do different things in different places. You know, people are seeing the changes. Birders are first noticers. That's what we all are. We're noticers first. And so noticing such things is important.
You are the canary in a coal mine for the rest of us. You are the warning sign on that, because you see the birds, you see those. I wonder at times, you know, was it 10, 20 years ago, did you start to notice change? You know, was it slowly, or was there a kind of a moment where you thought, this is not what I grew up with?
Well, yeah. I mean, part of it, it's, you know, some of the, there's so many factors in why birds are where they are. But then, you know, I can remember the blizzard of 73 in South Carolina, where we were knee deep in snow. And yeah, there have been other events like that, and helping people understand, okay, this is weather and local phenomenon, but what's going on globally with climate and those sorts of things. So I go to the coast a lot in South Carolina, and you see saltwater intrusion in places and the impacts that it's having on things like rails, black rails, and birds like that, and that where that saltwater intrusion is coming in, it's pushing back freshwater marshes. You see those changes pretty dramatically. And so it's, you know, sort of this overall life gestalt of things that you see more of, things that you see less of, and just sort of the overall patterns. And you sort of draw this line, this graph in your mind of what it is that you're seeing. And then the science, you know, those many data points that exist across the map help us say, yeah, you know what? This might have something to do with climate change. And I'll tell you where it's been extraordinarily dramatic is in seeing the devastation of native forests by things like hemlock woolly adelgid that have taken out this primary species in many of our eastern forests, our montane forests. And as that tree has disappeared, it has a dramatic effect on some bird species and where they can or cannot occur because of their dependence on that plant for various reasons. And so noticing that first has probably been the most dramatic things. I can remember being in just up from Virginia Tech in the hills there and seeing these devastated forests. And in South Carolina, we still had eastern hemlock. It was still nice and green. And within a 5-year span of time, it was there. And it was this scourge that just had just moved down the spine of the southern Appalachians and had taken out all these trees. And at the time, I was also studying Swainson's warblers with a colleague, Stanley Miller. And we were finding most of the nests of that rather cryptic warbler that a lot of people want to see. We were finding them primarily in young stands of eastern hemlock. Well, those young stands are gone now. And so it's important to understand how have Swainson's warblers and other birds adapted to these changes. So it hasn't, sometimes it's been a lifetime line and looking and saying, well, you know, I used to see more of that, less of this. But now some of it is sudden. Some of it is sudden because the impacts of warmer winters that allow insect pests to persist have these impacts on habitats that ultimately impact the birds.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. And Josh writes to us and says, on your current topic, this is another great example of where environmental issues and socioeconomic issues don't intersect often enough. Large portions of our population aren't exposed to nature and don't see how it could benefit them, but they also don't have access. Thank you for touching on that fact. Thank you, Josh, for the email. Gloria in Canandaigua on the phones next. Go ahead, Gloria.
I'm sure I've said this before when I called in. We lived in Milwaukee before coming Canandaigua, and there is, Drew, I didn't get your last name.
But, Lanham, yep.
Okay, I think that you would love going there. I mean, if there is, I mean, Milwaukee is always talked about in very derogatory terms, but there's wonderful things about it. yes, most of the population in Milwaukee is of color. And there is the Urban Ecology Center. I hope they will invite you there. I think you would love it. There are now three different park branches, and they have programs for kids to explore the woods, to explore, you know, ponds, to explore all kinds of wonderful things. And I would love to see something like this in Rochester, which is where I was born and grew up my young life.
Well, let's ask Drew if he's familiar, and then maybe Pamela can at least talk about maybe what Rochester might have down the pipeline. Are you familiar with what she's talking about?
A little. It's funny. This time last year, I was a youper for about a week.
A youper is the Upper Peninsula,
the
right?
Upper Peninsula.
The youper and the lopers.
Yep. I was a youper. I was up at Michigan Tech with a friend, a colleague, and doing some of this work up there, and met someone who had mentioned some of these programs down in Milwaukee. And so definitely a place I'd like to get to. I spend a lot of time over in Madison and Baraboo, so not too far from Milwaukee. So I would love to get there and see what's going on.
Suzanne off air called the program and just wants to know, how do you start a birder club for young people? What resources do you need, and how can you do it with little funding?
Well, you know, there are some young birder clubs around. This morning we actually met a young man, I forget his last name, but I believe his first name is Robert, just an awesomely engaged individual whose hair is already on fire for birds, but also for some of these larger issues, and he's going to be a leader. And he talked about connecting, not just here in Rochester, but this young man also wants to make connections out of New York City. And I can tell you, I have a friend, Nadir Saruji, in New York, who has this wonderful little club called the Harlem Bird Club. And they're young black girls out birding. And so, you know, a few pair of binoculars, maybe, but binoculars aren't absolutely essential. Again, I think getting kids out and just saying, do you notice? So maybe you've got a couple of pair of binoculars you can use. Most birders have multiple pairs of binoculars because we're obsessive about those sorts of things. And so we've collected these binoculars, and so why not give them out and let them be used? So go to your adult bird club, go to your Audubon group, ask them if they would be willing to donate binoculars. There are organizations, there are retailers, and who have programs. You buy 10 binoculars, you get 10 binoculars for free. And your listeners can get that link offline. I'm sure I'll make sure I get that to you, Evan, but it doesn't take a lot of money. I mean, you've got these public green spaces. Have people meet there. Have people gather around food. Have people gather around music. It doesn't have to be 100% about birds all the time. I know with the Young Birders Club back home, one of the ways that they've been successful is that they've allowed kids to get out and wander as they bird. I've seen people make the mistake of having Young Birders Club, and they tell the young birders, look, don't look down, don't look around, don't look anywhere but at the bird we're showing you. And that's a mistake. That's a mistake. It's birding is a part of being a naturalist. And so being a naturalist is being holistic. And so allowing kids to wander, allowing them to look at the insects and understand the habitat and ask questions is an essential part of it. So it doesn't take a lot of money. It just takes some desire to share.
Gloria also asked, Pamela Reed Sanchez, Gloria was asking about, you know, the possibility that Rochester would do more in terms of urban ecological education. What do you think?
Well, I know I can speak for the Zoo Society. We're working with the City of Rochester Rec Centers and their after-school programs, and it's part of why we went out to Humboldt yesterday. We're working with a number of the city schools and other school districts to do replicate some of the one cubic foot work that we've done. We also are starting a nature journaling club that encourages people to go out and just be with nature and observe it enough to be able to draw about it, write about it. And we want that to be intergenerational. And, you know, there are a number of initiatives that we're undertaking. And there are also places like the Rochester Birding Association that I believe do have a young birders group. That was where Robert was from that we met this morning. I think there are a lot more resources here than people realize, but it takes the effort and not much effort. It's a Google search. You know, but if we continue to not take the time to connect with nature, because that's the number one reason that people don't go birding, is the sense that they don't have time to do it. And or the sense of not just birding, but being with nature. We're very close to a time when the majority of people who live in this country who are operating seats of power will be people of color who are millennials, who are not connected to nature, and who grew up in urban areas. And if they are controlling the agendas, what does that say about the protection of our national parks and protection of our green spaces and clean water and clean air? And so it is something that I think we all need to be concerned about. It's not just about loving nature. It's about our quality of our life.
Got a few minutes left with Drew Lanham, who is the author of the brand new book, The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. It is a fun and important read. It's fun at times because if you're like me, it's fun to learn about nature in terms that you've never heard of or only briefly heard about or those kind of things. And then it is important in that understanding one man's story, but how it fits in this frame of a mostly white field and how we start to change that. It's just a really pleasurable read. And you can get the book tonight. So Pamela Reed Sanchez, Drew's here. You brought him in. So tell us all the details again for all those just joining. 7 o'clock tonight. What's
7 o'clock tonight at RIT. There's a free public lecture at the College of Liberal Arts auditorium. I believe you can park in the S parking lot. We'll have signage there, so it'll be easy to get to. Drew will speak for about an hour, and then we'll do a book signing, and you'll be able to buy his book there.
What are you planning on talking about tonight, Drew?
Well, Evan, you know, as a bird, as a birder, I think about range maps a lot, and I think about what limits where birds can be. And during this season, when birds are migrating, when there are these streams of birds above our heads as we dream in our beds, those birds are on their way to places that are more suitable for them. And so I think about those migrating streams and what causes birds to land and what allows us to see these wonderfully tremendous fallouts on some mornings. And at other times, the birds pass by. So in thinking about that sort of ecological exercise, I've kind of pushed it further into what I call this eco-psychosocial treatment of our own ecology. So how does the human animal, what limits us across the range of who it is that we can be? So when we think about these migrant warblers, when we think about migrating birds, and we know that there are habitats that are changed naturally by certain conditions that cause the birds to be where they are or not, but there are also human-made structures. They may be wind farms, they may be skyscrapers, there may be all sorts of things that present these obstacles that can cause birds to detour around them or sometimes fly into them fatally. For humans, I think the same things exist. So I ask us to not only see the range maps of birds, but to look underneath those range maps, to look at the poverty underneath, to look at the human condition underneath the ranges of the birds. And in doing that, we develop a more whole picture of how we connect to nature, how all of us connect to nature. A mentor of mine who I never knew, but who's had a great influence on my life, Aldo Leopold, said that conservation is a state of harmony between men and land. My question beyond that is, how do we hear that harmony? Does it make a difference whether we are Black American or White American or Hispanic, whether we hear the same harmony? Range mapping allows us to ask the question about the human animal and our range map underneath the range maps of the birds that we love so much.
You said in the book that you think about the land a lot. In fact, you said you feel possessed by it. I think about when you talk about range maps, I think about kids who don't see a lot of land, whose world experience is very limited. It's limited in their neighborhood, maybe going to school, hopefully staying in school, not always. And I think, you know, they're short miles away from Olmsted parks and green spaces that are amazing, but their range map is very small. And so much of this conversation, these related conversations, they tie back to, you know, something so easy as just fixing poverty. That's easy, right? But that's just so much a big part of it, because poverty is limiting in so many ways, and alleviating poverty means more experience and a wider range map. And I just love the way you connect everything to birds, man. I mean, birders have a great perspective on the world. It makes me want to... Can you become a birder at my age? Can you do that?
Adult onset birding, yeah.
Adult onset birding.
I will tell you that I have the title of odd. I have ornithological distraction disorder. and so, yeah, at any point in time, and birding does not require one to list hundreds of birds or watch birds daily. It, for me, I expand the definition of a birder as someone who cares enough to notice birds.
I love that. Well, we're down to our last minute, so let's just be real quick here. What's the coolest bird that you think we can probably see locally right now that most of us don't see very often or don't notice enough?
Peregrine falcons. They're on the buildings. They're on the buildings. A bird that can dive at almost 200 miles an hour? That's a superhero in feathers, man. Peregrine falcons.
Sounds horrifying.
Yeah. If you're a sparrow or a pigeon, yeah, that's death.
For you in your part of the world, down in whether you're in South Carolina, you're Clemson, more in the American South, your favorite bird, something that puts a hop in your step every time you see it.
Prairie warbler, little yellow bird that nests in scrubby habitats, oftentimes clear cuts. The first bird that I saw after my family lost the land, it meant hope. It meant hope.
Everything ties into the birds. It is a great story. Congratulations on the home place. I hope people pick it up and read it for a number of reasons, because I think they'll see the world in different ways, and I mean that on a number of different levels. But now I just want to go talk to my son more about birds. Look what you've done to me. So congratulations on the home place. Thanks for coming to Rochester, and thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Drew Lanham. You can get his book tonight at 7 o'clock. If you check out the Seneca Park Zoo Society's pages in various forms online, you can get more information on the RIT Talk at 7. The book will be there. Drew will be there. Pamela Reed Sanchez, thanks for making it happen.
Always
thanks for coming
in. Always a
pleasure,
Evan. Thank you.
Great stuff. Rob Braden's our engineer. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. And I'm Evan Dawson. And we'll talk with you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.